Off the Record, the weekly KOTO public affairs show that offers you, the listener, an opportunity to hear in-depth conversations on community topics and issues that matter. As always, you are encouraged to join the conversation by calling 728-4333. Now here's your host.
Good evening, KOTO listeners. Welcome to another installment of Off the Record from the KOTO News Team. I am your host, Matt Hoisch. Tonight, we are going to be chatting about women, specifically the women who make the Telluride region what it is, past and present. It's going to be a wonderful hour, particularly in honor of Women's History Month, which we are currently in. But really, every month should be Women's History Month, but, you know, we'll take it. Since this is the official one, we are doing it for that. And it's going to be a wonderful hour talking with some current women who are doing and have done amazing things, as well as historical women. And throughout the hour, if you want to, give us a call and let us know if you have a particular woman in the region that you want to give a shout out to, someone who is just incredible and you think deserves a little recognition. Give us a call, 970-728-4333. You can also send an email if you want. If you are phone shy, you can send an email to news@koto.org. Let us know some of the incredible women that you want to give a shout out to. Because as we are going to learn throughout this whole hour, the women are the ones who make our region what it is. And we have a call coming in right now. So before we get to our first guest, we're just going to bring up this call and see what they have. Hello, you're live on KOTO.
Hey, a question like that, the answer for me is Dulcie Ford. Amazing human being, incredible wife, great mom, funny, sweet, longtime community member. Anyways, I'm a huge Dulcie fan.
Oh, that. I love it. Anything else you want to say about her?
She was 16. We've been together for 30 years or more. Fell in love, living in Telluride. It's good. So much honoring.
You're breaking up a little bit at the end, but you know, we got a lot of the amazing stuff you said at the beginning, so appreciate you giving the call and giving the shout out.
Yes, thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, first shout out of the night to a wife, which is lovely. But kicking off our hour, our first official guest is Teresa Kanischnecht, Director of Programs and Exhibits at the Telluride Historical Museum. And Teresa, before you come on, we have another caller, so we're going to quickly bring them up. So one sec. Hey, you're great. Live. You're live on KOTO Telluride.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Doing well. How about you?
I went up and skied for an hour and a half, and it was really nice this afternoon. But if you're talking about great women, I'd like to give a shout out to Annie Savas, which missed most of our ski season this year because she was injured. And she's been a ski schooler for 45 years, and I just want to give a shout-out to Ani.
Well, actually, you're in luck. Ani's actually joining us for this hour later on, so you kind of...
Oh, that's awesome.
...a prelude, so stay tuned. She'll be on, but I appreciate you sending the good vibes early on. Thank you.
She was my boss in 1992, and she's a great lady.
Any story you want to tell about Ani real quick?
I just would like to say that I'm still on Telluride probably because of her.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful. Well, thank you very much for calling in.
Yeah, have a great night.
You as well. Thank you so much, listeners. If anyone else wants to give a call in to shout out an amazing woman in our region, 970-728-4333. In the meantime, Teresa Kanischnecht, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but it sounds like some good love.
It's our one thing when we have people join over Zoom, they can't listen to the phone calls, but, you know, we do what we can in the times of COVID. Teresa, thank you for joining us, though, to kick off our hour talking about some women who can't be here because they are historical women. We really appreciate it. And really, I mean...
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I know that you just kind of came in here prepared with some folks that you wanted to talk about. So, I mean, I'll really hand the reins off to you. I know that the first kind of piece of Telluride history you wanted to touch on, which was a big part with women involved, was the red light district and how that really fits into our quirky mining town history.
Oh, yeah. I think, actually, if you don't mind, I'd love to give, like, a little timeline context before we hit the red light district, because I think something, this is very near and dear to my heart, so I appreciate you inviting me. I wrote my thesis on women's labor history. So before we hit that really important topic, if that's okay, I'd love to, like, mention one thing about women's history that just came to mind when you were chatting, and I feel like maybe we should take as a little food for thought while we're reading articles this month about women's history, is you might see the phrase "before her time" a lot. And I would really like to just encourage us to maybe not say that or think of it in a different way. I feel like I've been reading that a lot in articles during Women's History Month. And what I think people mean when they say someone is before their time is that they're modeling behaviors that are, we think of like today, that are more common in our social stratification. But what I think we need to keep in mind when we're chatting about the women who lived in Telluride before us, and they're doing extraordinary things, they're doing them in that time. That's the whole point, right? Like, it's not the 20th century. They're wearing pants or breaking conventions in that exact period of time. And I just wanted to put that out there while I had a soapbox, because I think what we forget is, like, these women were suffering the consequences or breaking barriers in very real time, not ahead of their time. So just a little nuance there.
No, thank you so much for adding that. And actually, even, I guess one more thing before, I'm curious, because you wrote your thesis, as you mentioned, on women's labor history. Did kind of studying that history in an academic in such a rigorous sense, I mean, I'm curious, does that change at all how you think about history and particularly women's role in history?
That's a good question. I think it just made it even more obvious what we kind of know and learn about is that women's history is generally less recorded, just the way that our society worked, in like a European sense, especially. But yeah, it just kind of made it really obvious, like, change takes a really long time, and women have always been a part of that. So I wrote my thesis on labor union, or before there were labor unions, you know, and people worked hundreds of years for that. So I think, yeah, that's a good way of putting it, in that, like, we're 50% of the population, but we're not always represented in the actual history books. So that's what I think is really cool about Telluride history, because the small community gives you an option to include more stories about women in various ways.
Oh, I've never thought of it like that. I guess, what do you mean? Like, the small community allows a more inclusive history in a certain way?
So we can kind of dig deeper and learn about people on an individual level. So for an example, maybe let me start with our Telluride women's history timeline, which I made up in my head. But because we are in a box canyon, right, Telluride or San Miguel County is generally small, we can dig deeper and do more research. It might be harder sometimes, but we can kind of, like, pick an individual and really focus a story on them and learn more about their lives. Whereas if you're in a big city where people come and go, or, you know, there's just so much more to research that maybe you kind of lose those details. But what I wanted to say before we talk about the red light district is that women have been in our region and in this town we think of as Telluride for a very long time. And I just wanted to do a quick shout out to our indigenous women who lived in our region before Telluride was even a thing. So our Ute peoples are a matriarchal society. They're still here today. And they were living in our valley and visiting our valley for 900 years. So if you want to learn more about Ute history and the role women play in their culture, I would definitely encourage people to check out the Ute Museum, because that's not my specialty, and they tell their own story there in a really wonderful way.
Thank you for adding that initial framing. We're getting a caller in, so we're going to bring them up real quick and see what they have to say. So one sec. Hello, you're live on KOTO.
Hi, I just wanted to call out a special woman.
Please do.
Hannah Smith. If you know her, you know why. Hannah, we love you. Thanks, y'all. Have a good one and happy Women's Month in history. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Thanks for that shout-out to Hannah Smith. And We know that a lot of people really loved her. Well, Teresa, we are carrying on. Is there anything else that you wanted to add, I guess, in your timeline of women's history that you have in your head?
I was really lucky to know Hannah. So when we're talking about badasses, she's definitely on the list. I think what comes next in the Telluride history timeline is thinking about, really, women had to be hardy and go through extraordinary circumstances when they came to early boomtown Telluride. So when you're thinking about how our town was settled, definitely people came here, obviously, for mining. And those people typically tended to be men. So the first women we actually have record of, it's really fascinating, are three sisters. And they came and settled with their brother in San Miguel City, which is located where the Shell station is. And they kind of gained some notoriety because they were the only three women out of hundreds of men. So when we think about that, coming to a town that really doesn't have roads, there's very limited stores, no central heating. You kind of have to remember just how incredibly difficult just daily life was for our mountain women. And I'm so glad I live today because they put up with some extraordinary circumstances in this early Telluride.
And it's so interesting. I mean, even in preparing for this hour, I not nearly as rigorous a background as you, but even just imagining, I mean, the place we live in, it's hard now for different reasons, but as you're saying, it must have been so much harder back then. And it's just crazy for, you know, I guess to think about all of the daily work that I would imagine women did that probably just went unappreciated, that is just so essential.
Absolutely. Like, that was just the way it was for them. But when we think about it, they were, you know, they had so many more hurdles in their day-to-day life, and they were just really tough, determined women. And there weren't that many of them here at first. So I think you have a lovely little bit of a poem you want to play later. So I would love to contextualize kind of the next wave, if we want to think of it that way, of women who generally came to mountain towns or mining towns in particular were sex workers. So after Telluride proper was founded, we immediately set up a red light district where gambling, drinking, prostitution, and general partying went on. And that was just the way economies worked in general in Wild West town at that time period. And the red light district was our second most profitable industry right after mining. And women generally didn't have a lot of options for working during, you think, 1880s through the 1920s. It was more socially acceptable to get married than to work. So imagine you're a woman who ends up out west for various different reasons, and maybe her husband dies and she has no way to put food on the table. So the red light district workers usually entered that profession out of sheer desperation. And sometimes they were lured out here. We have strange advertisements for saloon girls, and I think plenty of them got tricked. So while it was this like really important part of our economy, it's also very, very sad to think about because their lives are really hard. And what we know about these women is incredibly limited. So we know they were being buried in our cemetery. We know that they were living here and in our census and contributing to the economy, but remembering their names, and you know, they probably didn't have a lot of family or a lot of education, it's really hard to remember them in the historical record, which is why I love Kirsten Bridger's poems that she bases on the demi-monde, which is women of the half world. And they literally were a different part of society in Telluride. They were not allowed to cross north of Main Street. They did not mingle with respectable women, so to speak, that middle to upper class. And so that was a definitely very different part of Telluride society, is this social stratification of women, because that was such a big part of our economy. It was just much more in your face here and in other mining towns.
It's such a I mean, it's one of those things I feel like, you know, where I feel like things, you know, like the Old West are often very romanticized in movies or plays or things like that, as, you know, saloon life and things like that. And it's so, I mean, when you lay out just like the on the ground realities, though, for, you know, people like these women in the red light district, for instance, it's just, it's so gritty and tough and really heartbreaking in a lot of ways.
It is. Yeah. And I think there's like a fine line because, we want to remember them as individuals, and they did have agency in many ways. Like, they had the ability to make decisions about their life, and a lot of those decisions were just really hard. So I think you're right in that remembering that, like, realness of our history maybe doesn't always get said when we pass Popcorn Alley. They were definitely probably not brightly colored like that. And it was just a different reality in many ways. It was much more visible than things we think about today in that line of work.
You mentioned a lot of them even being buried in our cemetery. Do you have any estimate for, like, the actual number of women from the red light district who are buried in the cemetery?
Oh, goodness. You know, I'm actually kind of working on a little project for an interested patron who wants to create a headstone in remembrance of them. So just without actually trying to look very hard, I probably have 20 to 30 names with no actual marked location.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so, you know, there were more people living here in Boomtown Telluride. There were closer to 5,000 people. And people came and went a lot, and it was just a very different mobile boom and bust economy. So there are probably many more that we don't know about.
It's also a bit crazy to think that the population of Boomtown Telluride was actually larger than the current population.
Yeah, it was about Telluride and Mountain Village combined, if we think about it that way. Yeah, it was quite the bustling city, and women were a huge part of it. So I definitely think remembering the red light district as this, like, less talked about, but it was part of everyday life. You couldn't walk down the street without thinking, oh, south of Main Street is, you know, the demi monde where they live. So that is definitely people that I like to remember when we're talking about Telluride history.
Well, time is our enemy, unfortunately. We have a bit of time left. Now, there was at least one other woman you really wanted to highlight was Dr. Anna Brown. Could you talk a bit about her?
Oh, yeah. I will mention her briefly just because I think she kind of showcases that other working class, middle to upper class section of Telluride. And she was also super important in our community for almost 30 years. So Dr. Anna Brown was a doctor when it was difficult for women to do so. And she helped our community stay healthy during various epidemics, including diphtheria, scarlet fever, and other diseases before we really knew about germ theory, before we had antibiotics, and before we had vaccines. And then she became our public health officer. So she would quarantine people and keep, she was like our first contact tracer, really. She would keep track of how people were getting sick, and the only tool they had was to quarantine. And she's in the paper all the time for reminding people, nope, you got to stay in your house for 6 weeks. And she saved countless lives. And then when the 1918 flu came around, she is the reason that Telluride's death rate didn't skyrocket like Silverton's in many ways, because she had done this before, and she was a very educated and exceptional woman. And she's just one of my favorite stories. So she's also, we have her, a little bit of an exhibit on her in the museum if you ever want to come check it out.
That's just so insane. And I wish we could just talk about her a lot more, honestly. That's a bit of a tease almost.
I know, she's so great. Thank God for Dr. Anna Brown.
But really, Teresa, before we have to let you go, because time, as I mentioned, is our enemy, I do want to ask a bit of a bigger picture question, maybe, which is, when you look at our region through the lens of the women who have made it over the decades, I'm curious if anything surprises you or stands out to you. I mean, you've alluded a bit that we were a bit of a different region in some ways, but just, anything surprise you in our history in terms of the women who have helped make it?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess one thing that I forget about because I didn't grow up in Colorado, I grew up in the Midwest, is that Colorado women had the right to vote much earlier in state elections, not national, but they had the right to vote before a lot of other states. And you actually see that in our newspapers, like women canvassing and just being involved in local politics and utilizing that right. And I just think that's something we don't necessarily think about, because technically women didn't get the vote until later. So that's an interesting and fun way to look at Colorado, is that women were utilizing this right as soon as they got it, and they were doing it in Telluride.
I love that. Well, Teresa Kanishnacht, Director of Programs and Exhibits at the Telluride Historical Museum, just thank you for kicking off this hour and really, I think, framing it just in a really interesting, poignant way. And I can already tell I wish we had more time with you, but I'm so glad you could join us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and I'm excited to listen to the other ladies.
Bye, Teresa. Well, listeners, as Teresa mentioned, we actually have a bit of another way to think about the history of the women in our region, which, as Teresa mentioned, we don't have as much documentation about all of it. But one resident, one local, Kirsten Bridger, has kind of taken a bit of a more creative approach to trying to understand some of these women. She's written collections of poetry based on some of the women of the night, the women of the red light district, the demimonde, as Teresa mentioned, written poetry, placing herself in a lot of ways in their shoes. And so we are going to now play one of her poems, which is, the poem is called Talking to Lizzie Who Talks to Furniture. This poem is one of a new collection she's releasing soon. And in that collection, she's detailing the known facts about a real woman who really did live, named Lizzie Daly, who is actually buried in the Lone Tree Cemetery right here in Telluride. She was born in 1890 and died in 1915. And Kirsten wrote this collection of poetry trying to give her life a bit of a voice. So here is Talking to Lizzie Who Talks to Furniture by Kirsten Bridger.
Talking to Lizzie Who Talks to Furniture. And what, dear Elizabeth, did you say there in your last room on Pacific Street? You took your last breath of mountain air so far from the coast. Tell me, did you ever whisper California into the stale white lace curtains as you stared through the holes until they went black? You were so far from home. Did you lose a bet and ride those rails so long it became hopeless to look back? Asking the coal bin if there was gold somewhere for you. Your brass wedding band long gone, your name slipping away. The paper said you died of acute peritonitis, a vague diagnosis for a vague set of speculations. 18 months before you died, a denizen of the red light, you'd wed a man in a small town back east, where you did not have to chat with a rusted hope chest, or maybe you did, lonely in a congested room. Oh, Lizzie, most women like you didn't get written about, didn't get a headstone, but you got both, and friends who protested when clergy did not do right by you. No service on Sunday, the paper printed. The complaint, but yours was a minor death. Did you disclose your real name into the hollows of your one drawer in the sagging chest? Did you sigh into the belly of your wash basin, hide your tear streaks in the water you cupped? Did you tell the bedpost the name of your childhood friend? Did you avoid books of the Bible because Pastor Joe liked his thrusts New Testament style? When the wainscot was mute, when the iron vine on the barred window failed you, did you look to borrow a pet? Some small breathing thing to coax and praise when your knee was bruised purple to yellow and back again? Would you mouth, "This is relentless," to the doorknob as the key whole eyed you back again until you were the first to blink. Oh, sweet Liz. When the wine soured your stomach and the song left your throat, did you finally voice why you fled? How you found yourself here in this scuffed boot town, besotted no longer, as you lay in this deep-set Fox Canyon pawing at death? Did you whisper your reason into that sweat-soaked sheet before turning against the lamplight to end the spiral, the maddening scene?
Talking to Lizzie, Who Talks to Furniture, a poem by Kirsten Bridger, a local writer. That poem is a part of a collection that she's going to be publishing soon. She has another collection also about local women of the night. That collection is called Demimonde. But Kirsten, thank you so much for recording that and for giving us that different kind of glimpse into the lives of some of the women who lived here in the early 20th, late 19th century. Like Teresa mentioned, it's, I think, historic, looking at these women historically, it's harder to get some of the sources. And so having that sort of creative lens in is very helpful. Listeners, if you are just joining us, I'm Matt Hoyce from the Kodo News team. This is Off the Record. And tonight we are chatting about the women who make our region what it is, because our region would not be what it is without the incredible women who do all of that. If you want to give a shout out to an incredible woman, give us a call, 970-728-4333, or send an email to news@koto.org. We want to give some recognition to as many incredible women in our area as we can. We actually got a couple of shout outs even before the show, one from our very own library executive director, Sarah Landreau, who wants to give a shout out to the wonderful team of ladies at the library, and they are Amy Sieving, Jill Wilson, Erin Hollingsworth, Sandy Dwight, Gloria Chavira, Jeannie Stort, Tracy Lindauer, Allison Farnham, Tiffany Osborne, Maggie McNally, Joanna Spindler, Laura Colbert, Carly Solomon, Rachel Lefebvre, Alice Martin, and Teresa Westman. Sarah writes, "These artists, activists, athletes, and all-around great people really rock and get things done. Their energy and enthusiasm is contagious in a good way." Hear, hear, Sarah Landreau. Also a big shout out to you for leading the library. But gosh, I don't know what this pandemic would have been without the amazing people at the Telluride Library, including all of the wonderful women. So thank you, Sarah. Listeners, if you want to give a shout out, 970-728-4333, or send an email to news@koto.org. Joining us in studio, we have another incredible woman from our region joining us in the flesh and masked, distanced, I will say also, Miss Franny Patricio, one of the first women to work in the mines. Franny, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. My pleasure. You bet, I should say.
All right. First question, Franny, is got to be, just tell us the story. How did you end up working, coming to Telluride and working in the mines?
Well, I'm one of the few people, I guess, who moved here to actually get a job in the mine, not to ski. Because, in the 70s, there were like groups of people. There was the Bucknell group. You know, a few people would come out here to ski, and they'd tell their friends would come out. And there was the Detroit group, the Michigan group, and there was the Santa Cruz group. And in 73, 74, the mine really needed a lot of workers. And so a couple of friends of mine had graduated college and couldn't find a job in Santa Cruz. So in 74, there was our first friends who came out were skiers, Miquette Magnuson, may she rest in peace, and Tony Grant. They did come out to ski. And then they told these other friends of mine, well, they're hiring in the mine. And so they came out here, having graduated from UC Santa Cruz, to work in the mine. And then they came out in 74, and then I came out in the off season of 75 with a backpack and two dogs is all I had to my name, and got a job in the mine. I started on May 5th, 1975.
Hot damn.
And I just fell in love with the place. And when I went in to apply, then Cecil Goldsworthy interviewed me, and you know, there were these mining families, the Goldsworthys. There were Manny, Cecil, and Fred, the brothers that worked there. And I had opened oysters on Puget Sound. I told him I had done that job. I was young, and he said, if you can open oysters, you can work in the mine. And then the other guy, I don't know who he was some company guy, he said, you're going to have to lift drills. They weigh 185 pounds. He was trying to intimidate me. And so I said, well, gee, you look like you like weigh 185. Here, let me see if I can pick you up. So I started walking towards him. He said, no, that's okay. So then my friend Leonora, who brought me out here, she was the first woman. And then Robin Willis, who still lives in the area and drives the bus, she was the second woman. Although Robin worked on the other shift, so there were two shifts underground. There were a couple of local ladies that were watch ladies outside, but they didn't work underground. And then the queen of Iditarod was Irene Vizintine, and she was, a local lady born and raised here, and she was the office lady who gave you your paycheck. And she didn't like women underground. And she would give me dirty looks. Every time I go to get my check, she'd just give me stink eye.
Oh.
And then one time I remember, well, my cousin's grandfather had worked up at Tomboy when he first came over from Italy. And so I said, oh, my cousin's grandpa worked up there, and he was Italian, and she was Italian, and she remembered him. So after that, Irene was okay. She would smile at me after that. I passed her approval.
Oh, my God. Wait, so you were the third woman. I mean, why did they suddenly start letting women work in the mines?
Well, they passed a law, a national law in 1974 that previously all male places had to open up to women. And there was a real taboo about women underground. There was a taboo about women on ships. So when the Navy first put women on ships, and my father was a longshoreman, and no way did he think women should ever be on the docks. And so they had to hire women. And so that's how I got hired. And also for women in town, I mean, you could work, you made like $1.10 as a maid at the condos, or, some of the waitresses didn't even make a wage. They just got tips, and some nights no one would come in. It was so dead. Or you could work at the ski area for the season, just minimum wage, and the mine pay was the best paying job in town, definitely, for me.
What did the mine pay?
What did the mine pay?
Yeah, what did they pay?
When I quit, it was like $4.30 an hour. But like when I started, it was $3.50. Whereas like the minimum wage then I think was $1.10. So most, if you were just doing service jobs, you were making $1.10 an hour.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite a bit more. I was buying beer for all my friends at the Roma.
Well, I mean, tell us just about, what was it like? I mean, jumping into that environment, what I imagine was a very masculine, testosterone-filled environment as one of the first three women to just jump underground in that.
Well, I was pretty obnoxious the first 3 weeks because I was like, this is just like Disneyland. This is just like Disneyland. This is just like Disneyland. And the miners are like rolling their eyes going, shut up. And after about 2 weeks, I was like, no, this is not like Disneyland. But, it was a whole different world. It was a whole subculture. And within the mine underground, there were men, it wasn't just Telluride men. There were men from, Montrose and Delta. The Castle brothers came from, I think, Olathe or Delta. And then the guys from the Red Mountain side, from Ouray and Silverton. So there was a whole array of men. And some of them were super nice. Some of them never, there were some guys, especially from the West End, that were religious. They never looked at me. They never spoke to me because they didn't believe women should be underground. And that was fine with me because they were better than the jerks that every job has. But, I felt like I was going into their world. So I had to deal with sexist stuff, myself. I never complained. I just had to deal with stuff myself.
You say you went into their world. Did it ever start to feel like your world? I mean, do you ever feel?
Oh yeah. And like after a while, then all the hippies. In the beginning, there were a lot of hippies working there because they needed to hire people. Then they had a layoff for a couple months, and after that layoff, none of the hippies or women came back. I was the only one that went back after that. And then they closed the Red Mountain side so that the guys from Montrose and had to come in the Telluride side. And so it kind of changed the, what was going under there. But I got to work for all these different groups of miners. I wasn't working in one place, so I really got to explore the whole mine, you know, all the different places. And I nipped at the replacement mining, and then I was a nipper for just different miners, you know.
What's a nipper?
Oh, a nipper, you run the hoist that raises, so there's the tunnels, or the drifts, as they're called, are all different levels. And to go down to the drilling and blasting area, there's like a two-man skip, almost like the size of a coffin. And you have to, the nipper runs the hoist. I guess the proper thing would be the hoistman, but, you know, they had slang for everything. So with a series of bells, you would raise or lower. And at first, the men didn't want women under there, but then after a while, the guys started telling me they preferred to have me nipping because I was more, you know, I know this sounds stereotypical, but a lot of the guys were like really bored with that job. So, you know, because depending on how many miners people you were working for, if you were only working for two guys, you didn't have much to do. And you weren't supposed to read, but I did do a lot of reading. And so you would, according, they would ring the bells, and so you would raise and lower them. But now, if you raised and lowers that skip at the wrong time or the wrong way, up or down, and you didn't listen to the bells, then you could take off someone's finger or, you know, injure someone, you know. So it was a real safety situation. You were supposed to be on alert at all times.
Is there a story that stands out to you just in that period when you were working in the mine for those years? I don't know, just an experience that has stuck with you.
Gosh, I have a lot of stories, but I will I will tell this one as a funny one, because, you know, with that kind of job, there was a lot of horseplay, a lot of joking. Oh, actually, I should tell this one, another one. So I had two long breaks. You know, when you go on the man trip, the train that you take to go inside, then you're all crowded in. You know, all the miners have to get into this man trip, they called it. And, you know, as a good Catholic girl I was, I had my hands folded in my lap, and I didn't know that if you have your hands folded and somebody else puts their hands around your hands, you can't move your hands. So we're on the man trip, and this one guy grabs my hands, and another guy, I had two long braids, he started messing with my, he got his pliers and started messing with my braid, and he got it so tangled in that he couldn't get it out, and they had to cut my braid off with a knife. And all the other miners were mad at him, actually. And then just despite him, for like several weeks, I didn't cut my hair. I just wore that short braid and the long braid, just, you know, But there's a really funnier one, actually. Do I have time? Yeah. So there's a story about a ghost called White Boots. And I was a preschool teacher later on after the mine. That's my real contribution, is not working in the mine, but actually being a preschool teacher. But there's a story about a ghost named White Boots. And miners would say that they... So when you're in the mine, it's really muddy, and you can hear people's boots walking down the drift. And sound travels, so there's all these eerie sounds. And people would, like, hear boots and not see anybody, or they'd think they would see White Boots. And it was a story about this ghost who supposedly haunted the mine named White Boots. Well, I was working in the replacement area for quite a few guys, maybe 15 guys or, you know, that were working there. And at lunchtime, they sent me off to get some explosives that they call donkey dick. So I'm on my way to get the explosives, and I come around a curve, and there is White Boots, the actual White Boots. He had white boots on. He had an old wrinkly face, a scraggly gray beard, scraggly gray hair. And he scared me so much that I let out this blood-curdling scream. My scream was so loud that I scared him even more than he had scared me. So he jumped back, and then I realized it was a guy who had painted. It was all the guys were in on the joke. It was a whole joke that they had planned. And that guy, he had painted his boots white, and he had put a mask on and with the scraggly wig. And I was so mad. I said, it's a good thing you jumped back. If you'd have taken one more step further, you would have been suffering. So, you know, they like to play jokes and stuff like that. So there were a lot of jokes. There were a lot of practical jokes that they did to pass the time.
Is it a time that you look back on fondly?
I think, yeah. You know, like it's funny, as you age, you look back and you forget, like, you know, it was dark as the dungeon and damp as the dew. You know, it was pretty miserable under there. But also, for me personally, when I'm thinking about it now, I don't know that I would have stayed in Telluride if I hadn't worked in the mine. Because I came from a very, very blue-collar background. And at that time, a lot of the new people to Telluride were hidden trust funders. You know, and so there was a whole, you know, it was sort of like the ski bum trust funder scene. And a lot of those people are friends of mine, and it's great. But I, coming from such a blue-collar background, I really did, I liked that part of Telluride. And the miners who lived here before it was easy to live here. It was not easy in the 70s and the 60s and the 50s. And they lived here because they loved Telluride. And so they showed me all these, they told me about the history. They made me feel like it wasn't just some hippie playground, but rather a real community of real families. And you must have heard of Whispering Jim, huh? Have you heard?
No.
Oh, well, I met Whispering Jim. Can I do two more?
Yeah. Just for you, Franny.
So I'm sitting in front of the Roma, and Gerald Wilson, a local guy who worked in the mine, rides up in his motorcycle, and he says, "Hey, you want to ride up to Tomboy?" And I'm like, "Sure." You know, and I had my two dogs with me, and I just told him, "Hey, you know, stay." It was before dog catchers. And I hopped on the back of his motorcycle. I had a skirt on and no jacket, and we went up to Tomboy, saw a beautiful sunset, my first time up at Tomboy. He ran out of gas. So he's pushing the motorcycle. We go down to the Shamrock Mine. And at that time, we just saw no one else. You know, now Tomboy's like a highway. There was no one else the whole time up there or back. We didn't see anybody else. We go down to the Shamrock Mine, and Whispering Jim was there with his son Jim and their terrible pit bull that everyone knew, Sarge. And they called him Whispering Jim. He was born in Telluride. He's Pat Delpass's grandpa. He was born in Telluride. And they called him Whispering Jim. He was hard of hearing from mining, and so he hollered all the time. So there I am, this little, good little Catholic girl sitting in this old mine up on Tomboy Road, and Whispering Jim is just telling me, hollering. We're drinking whiskey, and he's telling me all these stories, and they had gas. And so they went and got gas and put it on the motorcycle, and in the motorcycle, and we drove back to the Roma, and my dogs were there waiting for me, so... And then I camped up Bear Creek. A lot of people, there was no housing here. I hear you're looking for housing. So if anybody knows housing, Matt's looking for it.
Thanks for the shout out.
But you can't do what I did that summer when we had to get out of the house we were living in and we couldn't find house. I had money. There was just no rentals available because there were so few houses in town and people came for the summer. I camped up Bear Creek that summer. And it just blew me away because in Santa Cruz, you had to go to Big Sur and backpack for hours to get away from people. I lived in the wilderness with two dogs the whole summer and had a 40-hour, and I didn't have a vehicle. And I had a regular job in the mine. I just fell in love with Telluride. And I think the mine was one of the reasons I fell in love with it. And the people that I met there, the local miners and their families. So
yet again, Franny, I'm going to say, gosh, I wish we just had you for the whole hour now. I wish we had Teresa the whole hour. You, I'm probably going to say the same thing about Ani, but...
Oh, Ani's got lots of good stories.
Franny, Patricio, the third woman to work in the Telluride mines. I mean, just thank you so much for joining us and for your energy and your stories.
Thank you. So take care.
Listeners, stay tuned. As you've probably guessed by now, Ani Savoth will be joining us in just a few moments to talk about her time in the region. It's going to be wonderful. So stay tuned. This is Off the Record on KOTO Telluride.
Everything. Oh, 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 yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything, everything, everything gonna be all right. Oh, yeah.
make love to a crocodile. I'm a woman. I can sing the blues. I'm a woman. I change old and new. Spell W-O.
I'm a Woman by the one and only Coco Taylor. It's a great one, I know. But joining us now is another of the great ones, the one and only Ani Savath. Ani, thank you for joining us over the phone. We really appreciate it.
Yes. So Whispering Jean used to come to my restaurant and tell stories. As a follow-up to... That was really good.
Well, for anyone who does not know who Ani is, Ani, you are the former director of the ski school, as well as the founder of Women's Ski Week, a former restaurant owner, and you've just been here since forever, it almost seems.
Yeah, it does seem forever. I came here in 1972, drove in town after hearing in Uray that the ski resort was going to open. Driving in, there's a couple of dogs in the middle of Main Street. You had to drive around. All the houses were boarded up. I didn't see any lifts anywhere. And I would look at Ajax and go, my God, this is what we're going to ski. Yes, and then I met Senior Mahoney and Johnny Stevens, and they took me up on the mountain on the snowcap and did some skiing, and came back down. I had a job for the next winter.
So you came to town for the skiing?
Well, actually, I was just driving through Uray, going back to Taos. I was going to go back to France. But after my little experience in Telluride, it was so beautiful and everybody was so nice. Johnny Stevens used to say, we weren't nice, we were just lonely. But... I met Becky Schuler, who showed me the song house, the space catacomb from La Marmotte there, that used to be a warehouse. And I met Jules Dolin and signed a lease to open a restaurant. So I came back at the end of the summer, did the renovations, and opened the restaurant a few days before the ski resort.
Oh, my gosh. Really quickly, I see that we actually had a listener send in an email to recognize one of our local women. It's Dahlia Mertens wants to recognize longtime local Janie Goldberg, who is a huge-hearted and very generous woman. She writes, Janie volunteers her time towards many community organizations, and she does a lot to make Telluride the special place it is. She organizes the gala fundraiser every year for the Adaptive Ski Program. She heads up the cemetery and makes sure it is well cared for. She rescues dogs, organizes the best Mahjong League, supports the theater, and she and her husband Steve made it possible for me to live in Telluride 19 years ago by offering me a place to live when I just moved to town and had no money and a dog. Plus, she's hilarious. Dahlia, thank you for that shout out to Janie Goldberg. Listeners, if you want to shout out a woman, send us an email to news@koto.org and we will try and get it in before the end of the hour. Ani, I do have to ask you, how did you end up becoming the director of the ski school?
I was running my restaurant, and in 1977, we had a dry winter. The ski resort was open like 32 days or something like that. So I decided, what am I doing running a restaurant? I'm a ski instructor. You know, in I came from Europe as a ski instructor. I was fully certified by then. And so I decided to sell the restaurant. T.D. Smith found a buyer. And I stayed on for the summer. I was supposed to teach the new owners French food. And that never quite happened. Anyway, for a film festival that happened in the fall, I would have to hire extra help because we would go from serving like 48 dinners to 130 or so. So I needed extra help. And I'll cut the long story a little short. I met my husband that way, who had been in the restaurant, and I knew of him because he was on council and all that. Instead of going back to France like I was going to do, I stayed. We got married. And that winter, Ted Slater and I started the race department for the mountain. There had never been an official race department. So we had a timing equipment, a timing box, and we would ski to different ski runs with our box with timing equipment, and we would set up. So it was actually wonderful. You know, we had a downhill that would start from the top of the Kunskin lift down where the park is now, that used to be Sea Forever, all the way down to the base of what is now Lift 4. And so that was a downhill. Then we would go different places for slalom and GS and all that. And every time we had a race, of course, it snowed. So it was an interesting winter. But that winter, Mr. Allred bought the ski resort. And he had a hard time ever meeting the ski school director who had a franchise. Peter Brinkman had leased the business on the ski resort and was running the ski school, but Mr. Allred could never meet him. So he got the ski school back out from the contract, and I was offered the job by Johnny Stevens, and a few of the instructors who had been teaching pretty much full-time were pushing me to do it. Well, for me, it was like, my God, I'm a woman. I came from France. In France, ski school directorship were reserved for World Cup skiers of the local. Even Annie Famos, who was the gold medalist on the French team, could only run a kids' ski school, and she wasn't even the official director. So it was like, you know, I'm not near that level of skier. But, you know, everybody was going, well, you can do it. Okay, I'll do it for 5 years and then, you know, get the business going, and then I'll do something else. And I went all the way to 2001.
Longer than 5 years.
I finished as vice president of the revenue department on the mountain, not the food service, but the ski school race department, special events, and different other departments.
You also You've done a lot in our community, but one other thing you did in line with somewhat the theme of our show is you also founded Women's Ski Week. And I'm curious, at the time, I guess, what did you see as the value and the need to found something like a Women's Ski Week?
So, in those years, the ski business was not only stagnating, but participation in the sport was dropping. And the National Ski Area Association was trying to think about ways to generate. And really, when you look at it, when there's a family with kids, the mother usually decides where things are going to go. In those days, the easiest vacation was to pack a couple of swimsuits on up on the plane and go to the beach. And so I thought, well, if we can turn women around and give them really good, fun experiences and they can improve their skiing, and then they will bring the family with them, and that will help grow the sport. So first year, you know, we didn't have much of a marketing department, and there was hardly any money. I mean, the business was just starting, and Telluride, you know, you would talk about Telluride, and people would say, where, you know. Anyway, we had one woman signed up, Laverne from Texas, and she had signed up to meet other ladies. So that was a problem. So I gave her a baton and say, okay, let's just go skiing together. Well, we hop on what was lift three then, that started from where lift four is now, and ended up on top of Grimskin. And, lift three then ended up just above Gorno. And then you had to ski down toward lift four and right up four to pretty close to where it is now. Anyway, we got stuck, and we had to be evacuated. So she got quite an experience for her first year. But she came back the following year with some friends, and the program grew, and it grew so much that at one point we had like 85 participants.
Wow.
And that was a little bit much for the facilities we had at the time. So we cut it down, limited the number of participants. And to this day, Fonda Rogers is running the program. And next year is going to be a big celebration because we couldn't do it this year. The program started in 1981. So we got a big anniversary coming here. And, you know, we had great ladies instructors, and I'd like to name that, some of them.
Please.
Cindy Smith was already here and participated in that part. Marty Martin Kunz, who was our speed record lady, who has a little display in the museum. Katie Jewett was there. I mean, there were a lot of really strong ladies here. They're still here around in Telluride right now.
Oh.
And that's really wonderful.
Ani, there's so much that's amazing in that. I mean, the establishment of all these programs. Also, I'm just astonished that you remember Laverne, the first woman to come to the Women's Ski Week, which I love.
Laverne was wonderful.
Ani, I knew I would say this. We are out of time, and I wish we had an hour with you. I wish this was just a 3-hour show, to be honest. But I do have to mention, before we let you go, that this year, this is multiple times you have been. This year you are again nominated to be in the Colorado Ski Hall of Fame. And I just know that I think all of our fingers are crossed to the max that, that this year you will finally be inducted, because you certainly deserve it.
Well, you know, the fact that Ronald Reds, Senior Mahoney, and Bill Jensen would consider me worth nominating me is good enough for me. If that's a great honor right there. So if it doesn't happen, it's quite all right. There are a lot of good people in the industry that have done wonderful things to keep skiing alive.
Well, you certainly are at the top of the list, especially in our tiny valley, Ani. We would not be what we are today without so much of the things you did. So thank you for jumping on and joining us and sharing some of your stories. It's just lovely.
Thank you for having me.
Bonne nuit.
Bonne nuit. Au revoir. À bientôt.
Merci. All right. Ani Savath, thank you again for joining us. And thank you earlier, Franny Patricio and Teresa Koenigschnecht, as well as Kirsten Bridger, our remote poet. Thank you to all the women who contributed to this, all the callers, all the people who tuned in. We really appreciate it. We can't thank the women of our region in just a single hour. It was futile to even try, is what I have learned. But we really would not be what we are today without the incredible women. Listeners, if you have an incredible woman in our region you want to thank, you want to acknowledge, tell it to her face. Give her a call. Give her a text. I don't know. But tell her, because we would not be what we are today without them. And I know here at CODO also we have some incredible women. We would not be what we are at CODO without Kara, Julia, Heidi, and Mackenzie. So shout out to those CODO women also. Anyway, listeners, thank you for tuning in. This has been Off the Record. We're going to have more Off the Record next week. We'll have more news tomorrow night. It never, never stops. But thank you so much for tuning in. And we are going to go out with another special song, a little Fiona Apple. Here's Ladies.
Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies. Ooh, my nation's on the lumen effect. Parallax view and the figure and the form and the revolving door that keeps turning out more and more good women like you. Yet another woman to whom I won't get through. Ooh, my nation's on the lumen effect and the parallax view and the figure and the form and the revolving door that keeps turning out more and more good women like you. Yet another woman to whom I won't get through. Ladies, 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 take it easy when he leaves me. Please be my guest. Do whatever I might have left in his kitchen cupboards, in the back of his bathroom cabinets. And oh yes, oh yes, there's a dress in the closet. Don't get rid of it. You look good in it. I didn't fit in it. It was never mine. It belonged to the ex-wife of another ex of mine. She left it behind with a note. One line it said, I don't know if I'm coming across, but I'm really trying. She was very kind.